This is a special edition of Writer's Voice, produced on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Many questions about the terror attacks remain unanswered for the families of the 9/11 victims, as well as for many other Americans. For example, why did the World Trade Center Building 7 collapse some 8 hours after the North and South Towers, despite being a block and a half away and untouched by either of the planes that took the towers down? Or why did NORAD, charged with keeping America's skies safe from attack, fail to bring even one of the hijacked planes down? An unprecedented failure for an agency that incessantly practiced just such maneuvers. And why did the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund mandate that the victims' relatives would lose their benefits if they tried to sue any of the alleged Saudi funders of terrorism related to the attacks? That was just one of the ways that the focus was taken off the Saudi attackers and misplaced onto Saddam Hussein, who had nothing to do with 9/11. All these questions and many more are explored in my guest Ray McGinnis's book, Unanswered Questions: What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. It's a detailed account of the FSC, the Family Steering Committee for the Independent 9/11 Commission, the stories of the families, why they created the commission, what they wanted to know, and how they were stonewalled and stymied in their efforts to get an accounting of the truth. Kristen Breitweiser, one of the FSC members, said, "We are going to get to the bottom of this, and we're going to make sure someone is held responsible so that nobody else ever has to walk in our shoes." It is in that spirit that Ray McGinnis, an independent researcher from Canada, wrote the book. It's a sober, even-handed, meticulous exploration of the questions still outstanding after 20 years. Well, Ray McGinnis, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much, Francesca. It's great to be here.
This book, Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored, is about the Family Steering Committee for the Independent 9/11 Commission. That is that group of September 11th families who formed this, the FSC. First of all, tell us just a little bit about who they were and why did they set this up?
Well, the families, all these families on the FSC lost a loved one on September 11th. The families were going to funerals, grieving, and then the Congress decided to pass a bailout package for, I think, $15 billion for airlines. And during that discussion, somebody in Congress thought, maybe we should give the families something too. So they created the Victims Compensation Fund. So suddenly the families who were in the middle of grieving and setting plans for funerals are getting, you know, notices about needing to go to meetings to learn about the Victims Compensation Fund. So that, so suddenly it's like Congress's legislation is in front of them. And so they're starting to go to these meetings, and then people start meeting each other. And over time, they start to lobby for an investigation because the president is not inclined to do so. And so they end up having a rally June 11th, 2002 on the Capitol. And about 300 families are there. There's also, I think, Joe Lieberman, senator from Connecticut. I know that John McCain from Arizona, Republican, was very supportive as well, as were a number of members of Congress, Chris Shays from New Jersey. So, you know, this bipartisan congressional and Senate support with a number of lawmakers. And so as the families met at that gathering, you know, trying to draw attention to the press to have a new investigation, they began to meet each other, and there were different groups that had formed. You know, Peaceful Tomorrows was focused on questioning going to war in response to the attacks. Voices of September 11th was very concerned about support for people who were grieving and accompanying people on the journey of grief and loss. Families of September 11th was, I would say, a more establishment group with people like Robin Weiner, who ended up on the FSC, who was president of the Institute of Recycling Industries, who was also a lawyer involved with Congress on legal and political matters, and Carrie Lemack, whose mother, Judy LaRocque, died in one of the planes that flew into the Twin Towers, was also with the, what I'll call the FOS 11, or the Families of September 11th, and she went on to become a CEO of a national security business called the Camilla Group. And then you have the September 11th advocates, who are known in the media as the Jersey Girls, Kristen Breitweiser, Lori Van Auken, and Patty Casaza, and Mindy Kleinberg. There were others, another group called Families for a Secure America, which was really concerned about not having, slowing down immigration policy, stricter visas, and tighter controls around the border for foreigners. And Sally Reaganhart and Beverly Eckert are both part of that. Sally had lost her probationary firefighter son, Christian, and Beverly Eckert, her husband, Sean Rooney, in the South Tower. And then the skyscraper safety campaign, Monica Gabrielle, whose husband Richard died, together with Sally Reaganhart. And what I start to see, all of these people on the FSC are members of usually of multiple groups, because you can join different groups. And so that there'd be 20 or 30 different 9/11 family groups that have formed for different reasons to have the proper burial of remains and discovery of remains of bodies from the World Trade Center, for example. But over time, they, these 12 people are identified from within these different disparate family groups to form the Family Steering Committee. And Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband Ron died in the South Tower and was a stay-at-home mom with a two-year-old in New Jersey, gave testimony to the joint 9/11 inquiry of the intelligence committees of Congress and the Senate on the 18th of September 2002. And her stirring testimony was a real game changer in Washington, D.C.
September 11th was the devastating result of a catalog of failures on behalf of our government and its agencies. My husband and the approximately 3,000 others like him went to work that morning and never came home. But were any of our governmental agencies doing their job on that fateful morning? Perhaps the carnage and devastation of September 11th speaks for itself in answering this question. Our intelligence agencies suffered an utter collapse in their duties and responsibilities leading up to and on September 11th. But their negligence does not stand alone. Agencies like the Port Authority, the City of New York, the FAA, the INS, the Secret Service, NORAD, the Air Force, and the airlines also failed our nation that morning. Perhaps said more cogently, one singular agency's failures do not eclipse another's. And it goes without saying that the examination of the intelligence agencies by this committee does not detract, discount, or dismantle the need for a more thorough examination of all of these other culpable parties. An independent blue ribbon panel would be the most appropriate means to achieve such a thorough and expansive examination, in large part because it would not be limited in scope or hindered by time limits. An independent blue ribbon panel would provide a comprehensive, unbiased, and definitive report that the devastation of September 11th demands. Soon after the attacks, President Bush stated that there would come a time to look back and examine our nation's failures, but that such an undertaking was inappropriate while the nation was still in shock. I would respectfully suggest to President Bush and to our Congress that now, a full year later, it is time to look back and investigate our failures as a nation. A hallmark of democratic government is a willingness to admit to, analyze, and learn from mistakes. And it is now time for our nation to triumph as the great democracy that it is. The families of the victims of September 11th have waited long enough. We need to have answers. We need to have accountability. We need to feel safe living and working in this great nation.
Kristen Breitweiser also said that we are going to get to the bottom of this, and we're going to make sure someone is held responsible so that nobody else ever had to walk in our shoes. Yet, as you point out, the White House under the George W. Bush administration stonewalled the investigation. And Dick Cheney, who many of us think was the real president of the United States during that administration, called the Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to warn him against doing an investigation. And as you point out, also GOP members of Congress also stalled it. Why?
Well, the official explanations given by the vice president to the press were that the nation was at war, there was a war on terror, and no money, no resources were available for having any investigation. When he was questioned about that, his next fallback position was, well, if we have an investigation, it will only give comfort to the terrorists. I mean, imagine being a family member who's lost a loved one. Mary Fetchett, whose son Brad died in the South Tower, in her testimony to the 9/11 Commission later, remembered that there was a Challenger space shuttle crash in January 28, 1986, and Ronald Reagan quickly got together a commission on the 3rd of February 1986 just to investigate this comparatively small loss of life to the attacks on September 11th. So the families are just dumbstruck. And I think, too, I want to mention that I don't know how many of these 12, you know, not everybody in America votes every time that there's a presidential election. I don't know that all 12 of them necessarily voted in the 2000 election, but I'm aware of at least five who said to the press how they voted in response to questions about their votes. And three of those five voted for the Bush-Cheney ticket. And Patty Casazza said that, you know, she was one of the ones that voted for President Bush, and she said she thought he would be their strongest advocate, but she found out he was one of their biggest obstacles.
Yeah, in fact, according to the chairman and vice chairman of the 9/11 Commission, who also were pretty... did a whole lot of stonewalling, they actually said later on that the 9/11 Commission was set up to fail. What did they mean by that?
Well, to begin with, they had only $3 million assigned for their whole investigation. And compared to 50 million plus, 50 to 60 million for investigations of the Clintons in the 1990s, variously for Vince Foster, Whitewater, and Monica Lewinsky. And so it seemed, I think the New York Times and other papers like the Boston Globe said that it seemed that the administration, by giving this paltry amount, was intending to simply starve the 9/11 Commission so they couldn't do their job.
And they also were not, they didn't allow subpoenas, they didn't subpoena anybody, they didn't ask for people to testify under oath. It seems bizarre. How can you do an investigation without subpoenas?
This is a difficult story and an interesting story to write about, because I don't think about these things normally. I don't think a lot about subpoenas on a day-to-day basis. But you've got Tom Keene, who's been named after Dr. Henry Kissinger, resigns initially appointed as the chair of the 9/11 Commission when the families meet with him and ask if he want to make sure that he doesn't have any clients by the name of bin Laden. And then he spills coffee on the coffee table and falls off the sofa and blames it on a fake eye and then resigns. And so then you have Tom Keene, who is on the board of one of the companies that are interested in this consortium that wants to have a pipeline across Afghanistan. So, you know, that's a bit of a conflict of interest given what ended up unfolding with the war in Afghanistan and the reason to go to war. And then you have Lee Hamilton, who was involved in the Iran-Contra inquiry. He was one of the people on that commission, and also a best friend of both Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. So for some people looking at this, the optics, like, will Lee Hamilton want to steer the commission in a way so it doesn't ask any embarrassing or damaging questions of the vice president or the Secretary of Defense? And then Lee Hamilton, Kristen Breitwiser and others were surprised that Lee Hamilton didn't think that there was any need to have any public hearings at all. He thought it would be damaging to the commission's investigation to have public hearings. He didn't want to have any subpoenas. He didn't want to have anyone swearing under oath.
And he was the chairman, is that right?
He's the co-chair. So it's just a very strange approach. When there were votes to subpoena, when they finally got the muster up to try and subpoena something, and they hadn't subpoenaed anything for about 9 months into the commission, so there are five Republicans and five Democrats on the 9/11 commission. And Lee Hamilton, as a Democrat, would vote with the Republicans against getting a subpoena. And so that was part of the dynamics.
The Joe Manchin of his day.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the rhetoric is, you know, partly in reading Kenan Hamilton's memoir, Without President, which is about their experience with the 9/11 commission, is that they didn't want to upset the White House. And so there's this softball approach to, well, maybe if we don't subpoena anything, we'll have a better relationship. You know, maybe if we don't make anyone swear under oath, we'll have a better relationship. But how much do you sacrifice in order to just get along really well? And it seems that was more of a priority than getting to the bottom of it, as Kristen Breitwiser wanted them all to do.
Yes, and I'm going to ID you now for our audience. We're speaking with Ray McGinnis about his book, Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. You mentioned that Henry Kissinger, who was originally appointed to the commission, fell off the sofa and spilled his coffee when he was asked whether he had any clients with the last name of Bin Laden. Talk about the connections between the Saudis and the Bush administration.
Well, you've got all kinds of curious things going on. You've got the Carlyle Group, which I think it's involved in oil and defense and other things. And you have George H.W. Bush, who sits on that board, who was at a meeting of the Carlyle Group, I think, on the 10th of September. There were other people who were brothers of Osama bin Laden, who are also on that on the Carlyle Group board, and they're also meeting there too in Washington, D.C. It's just there's lots of ironies or coincidences around close connections. I mean, even the president had apparently, I didn't mention this in my book, but apparently he had a relationship even with Osama bin Laden going back in the late 70s, early 80s with the Harkin Energy Group, which was involved in oil in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia and other places. So it's just odd. And there's this network of the you know, maybe the apple doesn't fall far from the tree in terms of, you know, maybe if sometimes your enemies are closer to you than you think, but there's an awful lot of people that are very closely connected to the seats of power that just happen to be having a business relationship with people related to the perpetrator of the attacks.
What's also curious is that the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund told the victims that they would lose their benefits if they tried to sue alleged Saudi funders of terrorism related to the attacks. So, you know, coincidence is one thing. Forbidding the victims to sue those who funded those who were responsible for murdering their loved ones is something else entirely.
Yes, and it also included the comments by numbers of people on the FSC where we want an investigation which is going to be a solid investigation and follow the leads wherever they might go. And that might even lead to people who, depending on how you understand or think about the attacks, there may be people who are assisting the alleged hijackers who may be American citizens. in or out of the government, wherever that goes. And so there's also, if you take this victim's compensation fund, you also cannot sue the government. And so you have Beverly Eckert, who's on the FSC, who decides not to receive the victim's compensation fund and wants to proceed with her own trial in court against the U.S. government.
So now let's talk about some of the failures, some of the questions that the families had and have, still have, for parts of the U.S. government. Like, for example, NORAD. Now, NORAD, I don't know what NORAD stands for, but those are the guys who, you know, basically would scramble military jets to stop an attack. And you say that it was, you know, extremely strange that they were unable to stop even one, when that's just part of their job and something they train for all the time.
This is true. The North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, which is all linked with the U.S. Air Force, whose motto is guarding the nation's skies. I mean, I had to look in the background of this. I mean, the families in there, there was a documentary, 9/11 Press for Truth, in 2006, that featured a number of the Jersey girls, and Monica Lewinsky, I think Sally Reagan-Hart was also interviewed, and Mary Fetchett. They pointed out, as they began to research things, because they couldn't sleep, and one less person at the meal table each day, and they found out that Payne Stewart, a golfer, had been on a private plane, and as soon as his plane got lost, there were suddenly six fighter jets tailing him and taking him down to the nearest airport. In 1956, there was the Grand Canyon mid-air collision with a commercial jet and a military plane. 128 people died. And then there were several other mid-air collisions, planes going through clouds and bad weather out in New Jersey, Connecticut, New York, Pennsylvania, other places. And around 1958, the forerunner of the FAA was created, and they put in place protocols. They, you know, the flying public needed to be assured, if I get on a plane, can I be guaranteed that my plane's not going to crash into another plane en route? So they got air traffic control now has to clear the flight as the pilot leaves the departure gate, that your flight is okay, that your altitude and your route and you know, is all fine, and so that you can fly with confidence. And so if a plane went off course, more than 2 miles off course, the FAA is supposed to be in touch with the U.S. Air Force, NORAD, and say, we have a problem here. Maybe the problem is a sick pilot. Maybe the problem is some problems with controls in the cockpit. Whatever it might be, get those planes up there. And usually within 8 minutes, they're there, because they're tracking radar and everything, and they know where to find these planes. And for example, the General Accounting Office on a yearly basis provides Congress with an itemization of the costs to the American taxpayers of doing these routines where flights or jets are scrambled up to meet planes that are off course. Because once a plane's off course, it poses a danger to other planes flying in the opposite direction. And so between 1989 and 1992, the General Accounting Office reported to Congress that there were over 1,500 cases where these intercepts happened. And I think it's important to say that when the U.S. Air Force sends these fighter jets up to be scrambled to intercept a plane that's off course, they're not doing this where they're getting like 2 out of 3 or 4 out of 5. They're batting 1,000. Like, they're getting 100% of all of their requests to scramble, because they have to do it. That's what they're expected to do. And you have pilots being interviewed after the attacks of September 11th saying, I don't know what happened. You know, in our Air Force base, we practice the drills 6 times a month to do exactly what should have happened. Or other people saying, I don't know. I mean, we were sent in the wrong direction, way over on the, you know, to the to the east of Long Island. But, you know, we could have gotten there if only we'd been sent in the right direction. So the pilots themselves expect that they can do this. And then there's the question of, well, what would they do exactly? People sometimes say, well, would they have to shoot down a plane? Well, they can go up on either side and they can tip their wings and indicate that there's a problem. And then there's a graduated number of things that they can do. And they can also, if you've ever been to an air show and see how the fighter jets can dazzle people with their maneuvers, these smaller fighter jets can do quite a bit to fly around and buzz around the front of a large commercial airplane and presumably even throw it off of its beeline, because in this case the not so skilled hijacker pilots wouldn't know what to do with a fighter jet whizzing around in front of them to distract them. So there's things that they can do to, you know, try and get them to come down to the ground. And there are other reports in the news over the years where there were occasionally planes that were being hijacked, where a flight to Cuba or whatever, and there were always reported in the press, and there were fighter jets, you know, tailing or flying on either side of the plane. So this is what was done all the time. And then, you know, you've got thousands and thousands of instances where this was happening, and then all of a sudden the families are saying, why is it 0 for 4 on this day of all days?
And there's more, because the FSC, the families, noted inconsistencies with the timeline of events reported in the media around this. So it's not just that they were unable to do this, but the reporting as to when they got alerted was not consistent. Different reports were not consistent with each other.
Yes, and researcher Paul Thompson, whose timeline about news stories related to the attack September 11th that the families found so helpful to read to help them form the questions for the 9/11 Commission, pointed out that there were 7 different timelines that were offered. I mean, everything from at the beginning, well, we didn't send any planes up at all. And then after that didn't seem to fly, pardon the pun, then other timelines came up. And the 9/11 Commission, hearing the generals testify before them in the spring of 2004, were so concerned, one after another, the generals testifying, and then you have these 7 different incompatible stories of what happened, and there was a serious discussion apparently about asking the Department of Justice to criminally investigate the NORAD.
There's another thing that I have always wondered about. I just could not explain. And that is Building 7, which was not attacked by the planes, was not even all that close to the two towers coming down. And that's not even to talk about the way the other two buildings came down, which I'd like to do in a minute. But just Building 7, I mean, why the heck did that come down? What's been ever the explanation for that?
Yeah, so families were concerned about, like, how does a building, 47-story skyscraper, steel frame building, just collapse, in under 7 seconds all of a sudden? Yeah, 5:20 p.m. in the afternoon, and what I found was interesting. I had seen the BBC report with Jane Standley about 20 minutes prior to when the building fell, reporting to the BBC viewers that the building had fallen, although the building is clearly visible behind her, still standing. So that was a curious thing. And numbers of families, I think, saw that and thought, what's going on here? But I was surprised to find that there were Several reports, and I'm not remembering the stations right now, but maybe the BBC and CNN, but it's in my book. And there were reports, two reports by 11:15, saying that Building 7 had fallen, had collapsed. So it's just a really, it raises questions about, well, why would a reporter be reporting that?
Hours before it happened.
Yes. I mean, 5:20 p.m., so 11, you know, that's 5-6 hours beforehand. Why would someone report that?
Yes. So, you know, this is interesting because, you know, like many people, I saw the documentary Loose Change, I think it's called.
Okay, yes.
Which is all about the engineering anomalies, how these buildings, even the towers, collapsed the way they did. And then just yesterday, the day before yesterday, there was an op-ed in one of the major newspapers, the New York Times or the Washington Post, I'm not sure which said that documentary was the beginning of the kind of wacko conspiracy theories that we now see with QAnon. You know, and that's just even people like Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Has excoriated people who wanted to ask whether there was something more, whether there was some complicity. You know, just as a question, I don't know one way or the other, but people who have put forward or have even talked about the collapse of Building 7 or the way the two towers collapsed, and you point out that firefighters reported hearing bombs in those buildings going off, you know, have just been treated as tin hat wackos.
The families, I mean, there are a lot of people who with Loose Change and since then have asked a lot of specific questions about how the towers collapsed. At the time that the Family Steering Committee is putting their questions to the 9/11 Commission, which, by the way, were received publicly by the commissioners as a roadmap for how to do the investigation, the only question that they asked related to this was to comment about reports of explosions at the World Trade Center. And Patty Casazza has said publicly that when she talked to her husband John in the North Tower, that he told her, "I love you." He also told her he couldn't get out, and that he believed that there were bombs going off in the building. He could hear bombs going off, and other of his colleagues up in the top floors. So that raised the question. They weren't asking the question out of a concern to think the worst, but they were simply saying, what's going on? Have the terrorists planted bombs, for example? And the president himself seemed to say in 2006 that he thought that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had been involved in ordering people to plant bombs in the building. So there's, you know, so there are questions. After the attacks of September 11th, 343 firefighters have died. And you have interviews conducted by the Fire Department of New York with 503 firefighters and EMTs. And this testimony was not used by the 9/11 Commission, although FBI were present at many of these interviews. And the families and the New York Times, interestingly, sued the city of New York to release the testimonies. And they did do an article on the 12th of August, 2005, so a year after the 9/11 Commission report comes out. And there are these 503 testimonies. And if you want to, like me, you can read one a day for 503 days in a row to see what they actually said, all 12,000 pages of it. And of those, there's over 100 first responders that discuss bombs, secondary devices, explosions, and they describe this in quite specific detail. I'll give some examples. Fighter Fernando Camacho remembers after one of the explosions in the North Towers, "I must have flown 30, 43 feet through the air." So he's describing something which is really close to him, an explosion, and then the result of that is he's flying 30, 40 feet through the air. So that's quite specific. Firefighter John Coyle was in the South Tower, and during an interview with one of the people in the press who were alive reporting from Ground Zero, he recalled about how certain he was about the explosions all around him. And when his father called to let him know what happened, he says, "I finally got through to my father and said, 'I'm alive. I just wanted to tell you to go to church. I'm alive. I just so narrowly escaped this thing,' he said. And his father says, 'Where were you? You were there?' I said, 'Yeah, I was right there when it blew up.' And he said, my father, 'You were there when the planes hit?' John Cole says, 'No, I was there when it exploded, the building exploded.' And his father says, 'You mean when it fell down?' And Coyle says back to his father, 'No, when it exploded. I totally thought it had been blown up. Just like, that's just the perspective of looking at it. It seemed to have exploded out.'" So these, and, you know, 118 testimonies, I mean, make of them what you will, but I think that if a real trial happened and you had 118 first responders, firefighters, the heroes of 9/11, coming before a judge and jury and giving this testimony, it would be substantial. And people wouldn't be thinking of it as tinfoil hat stuff. They'd say, well, what happened? Like, is there a massive breakdown in security? I mean, one person who I was mentioning this to, who knew I was writing my book, and I commented on this as one of the family's questions, they suggested that maybe there might have been Al-Qaeda terrorists who were dressing up, masquerading as caterers and bringing in huge chocolate cakes with grenades inside of them and going up and planting them in the building. And I said, you know, I don't know. All I know is that this is what the firefighters said. And if you're going to do a thorough investigation, you need to look into it. And you also need to ask them to testify before you.
It's a horrendous crime. And I just want to remind my listeners that I'm talking with Ray McGinnis about his book, Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. So there are all these anomalies, and this is just skimming the surface. There are many, many more in this book. You also talk about something that really interested me, because years before 9/11 happened, I remember watching a documentary about George H.W. Bush when he was the director of the CIA that was put out by a watchdog group about the security apparatus of the United States. So, of course, the CIA was part of that. And this documentary, which was, I wish I could remember the name and the name of the people who did it, but I remember at the time that they were, it was an organization I knew as being credible. They revealed that Bush had extensive discussions, that is the elder Bush, as director of the CIA, about what would it take to abrogate the constitutional rights, the Constitution of the United States, the constitutional rights and civil rights. And so I was very interested when you spoke in this book, Ray McGinnis, when you talked about the Project for a New American Century, a report that they published in 2000. Tell us about that report. What did they propose and why did they propose it?
So the Project for the New American Century, come around 1998, 1999, has on it Vice President Cheney, John Bolton, Paul Wolfowitz, others. It's about eight or nine key people in the end up being on the cabinet with President George W. Bush. And the Cold War is officially over. The former Soviet Union has dissolved into many smaller countries, except Russia. But still, it's having a economic crisis, and so there is pressure in Washington, D.C., given the Soviet threat is no longer there. There are some people who think maybe it'd be more helpful going forward in America to scale back the defense budget, put more money into parks and schools and highways and healthcare and other things.
The peace dividend.
Yeah, the peace dividend, you know, I mean, you've won the Cold War, so why not spend some of the peace dividend? But they think, no, it'd be better to have global dominance, full spectrum global dominance by, you know, 2020 or so. And so a way to have that happen would be for there to be what they call a new Pearl Harbor, something as shocking as the events of December 7th, 1941. And so Beverly Eckert, who's on the FSC, was one of the people who spoke to the press, saying that she found it disturbing that there were so many people who were part of the Bush administration that were part of this project for New American Century that seemed to indicate that they thought it would be, in her words, a good idea for something like what happened on September 11th to happen. And so certainly looking at it from some family's perspective, here's attack happens. And the next day, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld says, well, now we need to go to war in Iraq. Actually, he was the first to say, let's go to war in Iraq. And they're also saying there's a document that comes out in the middle of the month with a list of seven nations: Yemen, Syria, Libya, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan. And, you know, and looking back at it now, it seems that quite a few of those countries have already ended up in a war with America somehow, by proxy or whatever, or directly. So their families wanting to know, is this, you know, what's driving what happened on September 11th? Was it really a surprise?
And in fact, George W. Bush called September 11th a new Pearl Harbor, interestingly enough. Of course, that could just be a coincidence and kind of an obvious, you know, simile. But in fact, we have had not only these wars, but, never-ending wars, and an enormous increase in the military budget has just simply exploded. So you also say at the end of the book, you really bring up the question of democracy and of truth. You said democracy requires citizens being able to distinguish truth from falsehood, and there must be a social agreement that truth matters. And this is so interesting because, of course, now we can see from the, you know, September 11th to today, there has been a progressive assault on truth, and you say that actually the September 11th Commission was part of that assault.
It is part of that assault. And the normally when there's an investigation that's worthy of being called an investigation, people start to get leads, they get tips, and they follow up those tips and those leads, and they bring the people forth and interview them, and then they follow the leads wherever they go, however exonerating or damning the evidence may be to whatever parties are concerned that they might be implicated. However, with the 9/11 Commission, you've got the 10 commissioners, but you've got 80 staff headed by Executive Director Philip Zelikow, who had co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice, who had also written the paper on preemptive war and the war in Iraq before it happened. And he's the executive director, and he and the senior counsel Ernst May write an outline of what the 9/11 report will be, with all the chapter headings and the subchapter headings. Now, that would presume that you know all that you're going to need to say because you've already got the outline. It assumes that there's nothing that's going to come up throughout the investigation that will require a new chapter or changing a chapter heading, revising it, or throwing it out entirely based on new information that comes forward. The co-chairs, Keene and Hamilton, knew about the outline, and then the four men agreed that they would keep the outline secret. It came out about a year later, and the staff, there was a parody going around with the staff who were suggesting this was, you know, just you know, undermining it. It was a farce, what's going on, that they thought that the whole investigation was cooked from the start. So and then, of course, when the report comes out, all of the chapter headings and subheadings seem to mirror most everything that was in the outline. So it seems that there's not a genuine, and also Philip Zelikow was directing things, so he wouldn't look. And Mindy Kleinberg has commented that if you don't want to connect the dots, you don't have to. And Philip Zelikow was the only person who could connect whatever dots he wanted to, but didn't seem to want the report itself to connect the dots, and certainly not all the staff teams, who were all in their own little 8 different staff group silos, not knowing what each other was looking into.
You say here that if the ground of democracy is truth, the ground of autocracy is assertion. And what you're really saying here is that these guys were already asserting what was the truth before it was. I find it very interesting that the ridicule of the people who say that there was something more going on is that they're 9/11 truthers, as if, I mean, this is already bringing into question the whole notion of truth as something even valuable to explore.
Yes, I think that this is one of the most unfortunate outcomes of the discussion is that ridicule and mockery has been the stance of too many editorials and commentaries and people referring to truthers or conspiracy theorists or tinfoil hats. And it's, you know, what I guess what I would like to say to everybody who keeps talking about it in this way is like, you know, snap out of it. Because a conspiracy theory is a theory which originally was used from back in the 1880s going forward, just occasionally by police in their investigations to say, well, we're trying to put together how a crime happened. And so we're going to come up with a scenario and see if that works. And then if we interview certain other people that tell us, no, it happened this way, then we'll change our scenario to fit the facts. And then suddenly this term became torqued. But a conspiracy is a synonym for a plot, which the 9/11 Commission calls the attacks were a plot. And a plot involves more than one person. And unless you believe that only one person was responsible for the attacks on September 11th, you are by default subscribing to a conspiracy that there was a plan. And clearly the described official account is itself a conspiracy of 19 hijackers and Osama bin Laden and so on. And so it's a matter of looking at the best evidence to see, is it true, the official account? Is it true, but with some half-truths? Was there some foreknowledge on the part of the government? Were there people who decided to let it happen or worse? But that's what, you know, an honest discussion would involve just getting back to say, well, what do the facts show us? Not having people say, and this is kind of like back in when I was in grade 3, there was a thing going on in my elementary school where in recess, a certain clique was telling me and others, your epidermis is showing. And I didn't know at the age of 8, what an epidermis was. And I was very concerned and awfully embarrassed that my epidermis was showing. And I only learned later on that that was simply a very fancy word for skin.
Right. But what's so important here and that I would like to end this on is how much 9/11 changed civil liberties. I mean, the beginning of the surveillance state that we are all under now. The assault on truth, the military budget. I mean, everything changed. And what really seems to have changed was that's where America took a turn away from democracy. So it is very important, and I think your book is very important, to be asking these questions, the same questions that the September 11th families asked and the 9/11 Commission ignored, the book Unanswered Questions. Thank you, Ray McGinnis, so much for talking with us here.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. You know, one thing I thought of was that Sally Reaganhard, whose son Christian died in the South Tower, I think, she said that when the 9/11 Museum was opened, she said to the press, whose truth is going to be in that museum.
And that was Ray McGinnis. Go to writersvoice.net to see Kristen Breitweiser's testimony before the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11.